It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the number of fatal police shootings in Wisconsin went up significantly in 2017 compared to previous years. We'll talk to a reporter about that news. First, it's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Now that the Republican tax plan has been signed into law, both major parties think it could be a winning campaign issue for them in next year's midterms. We'll look at how it could play out in Wisconsin and around the country. Also, the FBI and its deputy director have been under fire from the president, and a federal appeals court rejected a challenge to the president's commission investigating alleged voter fraud. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Will the new tax plan be a factor when you cast your vote in next year's elections? Do you think Republicans should be treating it as a win? Do you think we'll see a Democratic wave in the midterms? And what issue should Congress tackle next? Call 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Craig Gilbert is a political reporter and the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Well, you've been looking and writing about how the new tax plan could play out politically. The polls show not a lot of support from the majority of Americans, but House Speaker Paul Ryan says he's happy to have Republicans campaign on that issue. What's the case he's making?
Well, I talked to the speaker last week about this, and he and other Republicans are convinced, because they are actually delivering a tax cut to most taxpayers, that people, even if they're very skeptical of the tax bill right now, will eventually feel the impact. They'll learn more about what's in the bill, and they'll be happy that they're getting a tax cut. And if that tax cut has a positive impact on the economy, and if the economy keeps growing, they'll be even happier. Now, that's their expectation and belief. Democrats are equally convinced that the tax bill is a loser for Republicans and a winner for them. It's a really interesting political case, because perceptions of this tax plan are fairly negative, and people are very skeptical, I think, for a variety of reasons, that it's going to benefit them for very much, partly because they may not know exactly what's in the bill, but partly because there's a lot of distrust, general distrust and skepticism toward Washington. There's certainly, you have a president in Donald Trump who's not very popular right now. Republicans in Congress are not very popular right now. And there's a history of tax legislation in which people are skeptical even of bills that are going to deliver them tax benefits. They're skeptical that they're going to see them. They're skeptical that that middle-class people are going to get most of the benefits. And so I think it's a really interesting but open question right now as to how this thing is going to play in the midterm elections.
You mentioned survey data on this. You've also been traveling around Wisconsin looking at politics a year after the 2016 election, and you were able to ask some people, I think you were in the Mauston area, is that right?
Yeah.
What did you hear people saying about
Well, I picked that area because of all the counties in Wisconsin, none swung harder from Obama to Trump than Juneau County, where Mauston is. And it's a blue-collar county. It sort of fits demographically the profile of the Trump voter, so I thought it would be an interesting place to talk to people about the tax bill. And first off, a lot of people, some people aren't following it that closely. There wasn't a lot of people weren't sure exactly what's in the bill, and many people were skeptical that it would benefit them very much, including some Trump voters I spoke to. So what I found was kind of consistent with what we're seeing in these opinion polls, which is that even a fairly sizable chunk of Republicans and Trump voters aren't particularly gaga over the tax bill. I also found in that trip and in other trips that taxes hasn't been like a front burner issue for a lot of people. I mean, people are more exercised over health care. So it's interesting in a sense. You certainly don't get a sense that there was this great clamor for a tax cut on the part of voters in general. At the same time, if taxes are not as salient as some other issues, it may mean that it just doesn't play a big role, positive or negative, for Republicans going into the midterms. We're not going to know for a year, what the impact is going to be. But it's going to take people a while to understand from their own paychecks and from their own tax returns exactly how they're going to be affected by this tax bill, which which really was not a grand simplification of the tax code. And that's one other issue that's figuring into this, is that it's a complicated issue, and the tax code isn't being made a lot simpler. It's only being made simpler in the sense that fewer people will be itemizing their tax deductions.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at some of the top national political news of the week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Craig, while you were in the Boston area, you ran into a local fella named Tommy Thompson, former governor of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
What did he have to say about all this?
Well, it was interesting. He grew up in Juneau County, where I was traveling in Elroy, and he owns a farm in Juneau County, so he does spend time there, and he's, you know, a guy that's got a lot of experience reading the political tea leaves. He said that he didn't sense any particular interest in taxes as an issue, any particular clamor for the tax legislation. He thought people were having trouble kind of understanding, because the tax bill was his first and foremost a business tax cut, particularly a corporate tax cut. He thought that was he is a pro-business Republican, but he thought that people were having trouble kind of making the connection between a corporate tax cut and their own wallet and pocketbook and wages, and that was one thing going against this bill. He also thought that Republicans, because they failed to sort of pass any legislation on health care, that had kind of locked in a lot of negative perceptions of Congress as ineffectual, and that the success they had in passing a tax bill wasn't necessarily going to change those perceptions. And so he had a fairly pessimistic view of his own party's prospects going into the next midterm election cycle.
Now, staying with that midterm election cycle, you mentioned you talked to Paul Ryan. He is interested in Republicans running under the banner of their tax overhaul bill. One open question is Paul Ryan personally interested in running, period, in 2018?
Yeah, I mean, when I talked to him, say directly one way or the other if he planned to run for re-election. I mean, certainly it's our expectation. It's been our expectation that he would run for re-election. He's got the apparatus to run for re-election. He just would not officially say or formally say that he was doing it. He said that we shouldn't read that. But there has been a lot of speculation about political future and about how long he wanted to be speaker, and now that, you know, there's this sort of notion out there that, you know, he's been working all of his political career toward a tax overhaul, and now that they've done it, you know, he can kind of declare victory and go home. I think, you know, the bigger picture is just that the speakership tends to be kind of a dead end politically. I mean, speakers don't last very long, and there's sort of nowhere to go after you've been speaker. So I think that's what's driving a lot of the speculation about, you know, how long he's likely to stay in Congress. He certainly denies the idea that the speculation that he could leave in the current term. You know, we'll see. I mean, there's lots of scenarios in which he's not the speaker a year from now. One of them is that he doesn't run for re-election. One of them is he runs and doesn't get re-elected. Another is that he gets re-elected, but his party loses the majority next November. And finally, the other scenario would be if his party retains his majority and he gets reelected, his colleagues don't reelect him as speaker. So there's lots of ways for his speakership to end in 2019. And there's one way for him to remain in the speakership, and that is for him to get reelected and the Republicans maintain a majority and for his colleagues to reelect him, which could happen. But I think in some ways the odds are against it, just because of the history I mentioned about what happens to speakers after 2 or 3 years.
And speaking of keeping that majority, I mean, there's talk, Democrats anyway, hoping that this could be their wave year, like 2010 was the Republican wave year. You're a numbers guy, Craig. You're watching what's going on in the country. You're looking at poll results here in Wisconsin. What do you make of, I know we're still 11 months out,
yeah,
but what do you make of that possibility?
So with all the obvious caveats, there certainly is a very real possibility that it's a wave year for Democrats. I mean, the main reason is we just know from history that the party in power tends to lose seats in a midterm election. And on top of that, you've got a party with an unpopular president. and you've got, you know, pretty high levels of mistrust, distrust, and negativity toward Washington and toward Congress and toward the Republican Party. And then you have a bunch of special elections around the country in which Republicans have been pretty consistently running, you know, 5 or 6 points behind Trump's own performance last fall in these districts where there have been special elections. So kind of all the arrows, with the exception of one very important arrow, and I'll get to that in a second, but most of the arrows are pointing in the direction of big Democratic gains. Now, the one arrow that isn't is the economy, and that is, so far, it's been very interesting that the generally positive economic trends haven't translated into better approval ratings for Donald Trump, and they haven't translated into better perceptions or more positive perceptions of Republicans in Congress, but they could, and that's certainly the Republicans' hope. So that's part of the dynamic, the mixed dynamic going into the midterm cycle. And finally, you also just have some structural factors that help Republicans, and that is that, you know, they have the majorities in a lot of these seats that are going to decide the outcome of the House, and also there are very few Republican incumbents in the Senate up. There are many more Democrats up. So the sort of political cycle, the nature of the seats in the states that are going to decide control of Congress does favor Republicans, but all these kind of grand political factors tend to favor Democrats.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the week in national politics, including the political outcome of the new tax plan and coming up President Trump's recent tweets claiming the FBI is tainted. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the tax plan will be a winning issue for Republicans next year? Do you agree with the president calling into question the integrity of the FBI? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're looking at the top political stories of the week. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We're getting to the president and the FBI. The president in his holiday tweets targeting the FBI, saying it's tainted, targeting particular the deputy director, Andrew McCabe. What do you think about that? 800-642-1234. And Craig, another tweet storm, this one related to the Russia investigation. What has the president been saying via Twitter?
Well, I mean, this is a hot topic for him on Twitter. I mean, he's been very outspoken. It's kind of a spectacle, I think, you know, to have the president, are advocating or arguing against in such a public way. That's his style. I don't think it's going to stop. But it creates, you know, this kind of very messy and volatile political situation in Washington over all the Russia investigations. You've got investigations in both houses of Congress, and of course you have Robert Mueller's investigation going on at the same time. The president outspoken against that investigation. And if nothing else, what's happened is that I think increasingly this has polarized attitudes in Congress and among voters along party lines over this issue. And I think while there is some perilous ground here that for President Trump, if in fact he were to move to try to fire Robert Mueller, I think there'd be a big political backlash against it. But short of that, I think what's happened is that, you know, it's kind of poisoned the waters, at least for Republicans. And that in itself is important, because if Republicans in Congress decide that they have a problem with the Mueller investigation, then that means they're going to rally behind President Trump within their own party if the Mueller investigation concludes with negative findings about President Trump.
Right. Do you think that this is there's a conscious tactic to call the FBI into question here with the idea that then it casts doubt on any conclusions they find? Or is this just President Trump being President Trump?
I think it's both things. I mean, certainly there is a strategy, I think, on the part of some to kind of damage the credibility of the investigation, certainly in the eyes of kind of supporters of the president and Republican voters. It's also the president being the president. We did see during the Clinton impeachment investigation, obviously Democrats and supporters of President Clinton were pretty outspoken about Ken Starr, who was the investigator in that case. So that's, I think, what's going on right now. The real drama is, one of the real dramas remaining is whether President Trump does anything to try to remove Robert Mueller, which, again, I think would be a very politically risky move, because even some Republican leaders in Congress, like House Speaker Paul Ryan, are on record kind of defending Robert Mueller and his role and his credibility in all this.
And Craig, you mentioned public opinion on this issue. What are we seeing in surveys when it comes to what people are thinking about this, whether people are thinking about this, and what do you hear when you're talking to people around the state?
Yeah, I mean, the surveys I've seen tend to show that more people than not are kind of vaguely supportive of the investigation, in the sense they think that it's appropriate and fair. But I think you are starting to see in the polling among Republican voters higher levels of mistrust than you did in the past. And I think those numbers are going to continue to go up. They may not go up. That mistrust and distrust and negativity may not rise among voters outside the Republican base, but certainly within the Republican base, when you have a president and you have Republicans in Congress and you have conservative media kind of beating the drums against the investigations, you're going to see those numbers continue to rise, and that has a political effect.
Is that something where it's going to affect things in the midterm election, polarize people more, maybe motivate people?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. I guess it could be, you're right, it could be a mobilizing factor for some Republicans. I mean, one of the big X factors in the midterms, of course, in all midterms, is motivation among voters. And you know, it would be, we're not going to see a Democratic wave unless there's a, unless Democrats are more enthusiastic and motivated to turn out than Republicans. I mean, so the party, you know, the party in power tends to lose seats when its own voters are demoralized and the other party's voters are highly mobilized and motivated. So if this somehow becomes a mobilizing or motivating factor for Trump voters and Republican voters, then that could, lessen the odds of a Democratic wave election, but it could also work the other way, depending on how this is handled. If Republicans are seen as trying to shut down avenues of inquiry and investigation, that could be a mobilizing and motivating factor for Democratic voters. I think for a lot of voters that aren't super partisan, I think they don't necessarily know kind of what to think about it right now, and they're kind of watching and waiting to see how this all plays out. I think it's a little bit of an abstraction. I think there, among Trump voters that I talk to around the state, I think there's some skepticism and cynicism about the investigations against him, but they're also, you also talk to a lot of Trump voters that have very mixed feelings about the president. I think those people, I think their minds are not made up about this issue.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about some of the top issues in national news. Lastly, Craig, I wanted to get into the president's voter fraud commission. There's a legal challenge from this group, EPIC, which is an electronic privacy group, saying, hey, this commission shouldn't have been requesting all this data from state voting files. This was rejected by a federal appeals court, saying, not on the merits, but saying this group doesn't have standing. They're not personally hurt by this. Can you talk about this whole voter fraud commission?
Well, presumably, you know, this allows this commission that the president established to kind of go forward with its work, but it's really sort of unclear where this is headed. You know, we've talked about issues that are polarizing people along party lines, and voter fraud and its twin issue, voter suppression, are issues that absolutely polarize people along party lines. I mean, Republican voters are more likely to be convinced that, you know, voter fraud exists in the sense that there are people out there that are voting that shouldn't be voting, and Democratic voters are a lot more likely to believe that votes are being suppressed by laws and rules passed by Republicans that make it harder for people to vote. The Voter Fraud Commission has also been beset by a lot of kind of independent criticism because among independent analysts, there's a great deal of skepticism about the issue of voter fraud and whether there's anything like voter fraud on a significant scale. And so this particular effort by the president, who you remember after the election, made some grand but unbased claims about baseless claims about massive voter fraud in the popular vote, which he lost for president. Where does this commission go from here after all this time? And so there's a lot of skepticism about what the end game is here, what they're likely to find, what they're able to find. And we're still, I think it'll be a long time before we see what the fruits of this commission are. But I think there's a lot of outside skepticism and doubts about where this investigation is likely to lead, where the commission's likely to go.
And briefly, very briefly, Craig, a story I keep seeing is that in surveys, more and more, we're divided as Americans on how we think about things, not by age or religion or race, but by partisan ID. If there's something's going to split us, it's that. Is that something you're seeing as you look at the numbers?
Oh, yeah, and that's been true for some time. I mean, it's just, the classic example is when you ask people, I think we've had a ton of polling in Wisconsin where people have been asked about economic conditions. And through much of the Obama presidency, Democrats were, generally thought the economy had been improving, and Republicans thought the economy hadn't been improving. And then as soon as Donald Trump got elected, there was a partisan reversal, and the numbers just changed overnight. And so Republican voters who have been very negative about the economy were certainly not just, it wasn't just a matter of being more negative or more positive about the future performance of the economy, but their perceptions of the past performance of the economy changed overnight.
Wow.
So, that's the partisan filter, which is really, really powerful for a lot of voters.
And that's a topic we'll tackle again with you. Thanks to Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He looked at the top news of the week in national politics with us today. Now, police in Wisconsin killed more people in 2017 compared to the last 3 years. The increase in the fatal shootings has some advocacy groups asking why this is happening and what can be done to prevent more of these shootings. Allison Durr joins us now. She's the crime and justice reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Appleton. She helped compile and verify the data around these fatal shootings. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, how many people have been killed in police-related incidents this year?
So far this year, there have been 24 fatal police shootings across Wisconsin, and those were across the entire state. We saw them from the far north corner all the way to the opposite corner. They've really been all over.
And how does that compare to other recent years since you started looking at these numbers?
Yeah, so the numbers that we looked at were from the Washington Post and the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. And those numbers showed that in 2015, there were 11 fatal shootings. In 2016, there were 17 fatal shootings. And then this year, year-to-date, is 24. So those have been increasing over the last 3 years, according to the data that we have.
But at the same time, you point out in your piece that while the fatal shootings have gone up, the number of overall shootings by police, if I have this right, remains steady?
Right. Yep, they've been about the same, year over year. So that's one of the questions that, is kind of hanging out there, is why are more people, dying in these shootings? And we're not necessarily seeing more shootings when you look at the fatal and non-fatal shootings combined.
And one thing that's complicated is, since these are different incidents isolated from one another, it's hard to pick out common themes sometimes. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, we really saw, a huge variety in terms of the circumstances of these shootings. We looked primarily into the 2017 shootings, and we saw, Appleton had a fatal shooting in a downtown bar where a bystander who was unarmed was actually killed. You know, and that varied all the way up to the shooting, I'm sure people will remember, in Wausau, where four people were killed, you know, earlier this year. So there was just a huge variety of these situations, and I think that's part of the challenge in terms of determining, you know, how do we address this issue, and that's part of the conversation, you know, that we're seeing, I think, in the state.
And yeah, talking to police representatives and police departments around the state, what do they do with this kind of information?
You know, I think they look at the circumstances, you know, especially when it's their own agency. Part of the conversation that you know, that we're seeing in the state focuses on creating more of a learning model from these shootings. So instead of, you know, each shooting kind of being looked at as its own, you know, individual incident, you know, there's a conversation going on right now about, you know, how do we kind of bring in a model that looks at what happened, you know, what were the circumstances, you know, what are the takeaways, and then disseminates that information to other police agencies so that, you know, the lessons can be learned, you know, widely across law enforcement.
And you talked in this story to a person who's been advocating for that kind of treatment, a Michael Bell, who lost his own son in a police shooting. We've talked to him on the show. He's a former, I think, Air Force pilot, and he said, hey, let's take these shootings and treat them like pilots do and airlines do, incident reports. What did he have to say about the data you're working on?
You know, he wasn't really surprised at the numbers. And when I talked with him, you know, I think there were 21 fatal shootings at that point, and since that conversation, there have been three more. So, yeah, he wasn't surprised by the numbers, but he said, you know, this is something that we need to be looking at and trying to understand so that these kinds of things don't happen, you know, to other people in the future.
We're talking to Allison Durr, crime and justice reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at the police shooting numbers in Wisconsin, people shot and killed by police. That's gone up over the last couple of years, but it can be hard to pin down a reason why. Allison, I want to look at how these are distributed. You mentioned these are across the state, and this is not a big city problem or a small town problem. There are instances in all different kinds of communities.
Right. And I think that was part of, you know, what was so interesting in mapping the data is seeing that, you know, we had three in the Fox Valley just in the last 3 years. There were, you know, about six or so in the Wausau area. Milwaukee had, I think, seven. You know, and Eau Claire also had a handful. So you really see these across the state, you know, in some agencies that had multiple, but a lot of agencies, you know, had one of these shootings over the last 3 years. It really just kind of runs the gamut.
I want to look at some of the particular cases here. You mentioned a couple that were both in a sense related to active shooter situations, the one in Wausau, and then you mentioned that bystander in Appleton where the police officer believed there was an active shooter situation going on. But in some cases, they appear to have been suicide attempts by the person who was ultimately shot by police officers, including in one case, the victim, the person who was shot, had what was in effect a suicide note and an apology to police. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what we've heard from, you know, from law enforcement. So, yeah, I mean, we saw that in a few different cases where somebody, it appeared later, was either trying to, you know, I don't want to say get shot, but, you know, had a fake gun or, you know, had the suicide note like you had mentioned. So, yeah, I mean, that was one of the situations that popped up a few times in the data that we looked at.
And in how many of these cases was the person who was shot by police, how often were they armed in these situations?
They were armed quite a few times. I think, you know, let's see, there were, you know, a lot of guns that we saw, knives. In some cases, like in the one in Appleton, you know, the person who died didn't have the weapon, but you know, somebody else was reported to have shot, you know, shot a gun inside the bar. So there was a weapon involved in that situation. You know, it's kind of an outlier. But you know, between toy weapons and guns. That was a pretty common theme that we saw in the data.
I want to get into mental health. Now, mental health is not a factor in all shootings, of course. It wasn't a factor in all police-related shootings, but it is an issue that police officers do have to deal with. What kind of conversation is going on about how police officers are trained to deal with maybe mental health emergencies?
Yeah, so there's crisis intervention training, and that's one kind of training that officers receive, not just in Appleton, but across the state. I don't know that there's a solid number for how many officers have been trained in crisis intervention, but that's one method that you hear come up quite a lot. And part of that is de-escalation. So, using communication skills to try to de-escalate the situation. And that's another thing that's come up, in interviews with police.
Is it a thought that maybe in some of these situations, having those mental health and de-escalation techniques might have prevented the need for the use of force by police? In some cases, clearly not, if there was an active shooter situation. But could this be a preventive measure for future police shootings?
I don't know if there's a good way to gauge that. It's kind of hard to say what would have happened or what could have happened. And we didn't get too deeply into, whether officers had that were involved in these situations had crisis intervention training or whether they hadn't. But I know one of the things that came up, too, was not just, mental health training for officers, but also, kind of how do we look at this at a larger societal level and think about, are we addressing the mental health needs that, might lead people to be in these situations?
In Wisconsin, there's a law now that when there is a police-involved shooting, an outside agency has to investigate that. That's automatic, where it used to be optional. In talking to people involved in this story, was there agreement that that was a benefit, that was a good thing to have happening?
I think Michael Bell, the man who lost his son, he was really instrumental in getting that passed. And so we had talked with him a little bit about that, and I think with, law enforcement agencies at this point, it's kind of, part of the system. It's just how it, how these things go, when there's a police shooting or an officer-involved death, the automatic kind of response is to just turn to another agency. So that wasn't something that, we delved too deeply into with, at the various agencies, because I think that's, to some extent, just kind of an accepted step at this point.
We'll leave it there for now. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Allison Durr is a crime and justice reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about an increase in fatal police shootings in Wisconsin and the potential causes. Now, Americans gave more than $350 billion to charity last year, and one of the biggest times to give is during the holiday season and at the end of the year. While people are opening their hearts and wallets to do a kindness, we want to make sure we're giving to a legitimate organization. Jim Temmer is the CEO of the Better Business Bureau Wisconsin. He has some advice on how we can give safely and thoughtfully this holiday season. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, my pleasure. Always great to talk to you and your audience.
The holiday giving season, by and large, a positive thing. A lot of people being very generous. But let's look at the negative side. How common are apparently charitable scams around the holiday season?
Unfortunately, they're very charitable. The charitable giving, our hearts open up this time of year. We're looking to help people out, and the scammers know that. And what they do is they take advantage of people. And almost every scam really relies on those scammers touching an emotional chord. And again, this time of year, people looking to make charitable donations, they have scams, they have fake websites. There's a lot of ways they do it, but it all relates back to having communication with you as an individual. So number one tip, if you're getting pressured, if that's on the phone, if it's in an email, if it's a knock on the door, stop communicating with them. Hang up the phone, delete the email. You can shut or not answer your door. Don't feel pressured into making a contribution that you may not want to make. And if you do want to make it, take some time and go visit the website or call them back. A legitimate charity will want your money tomorrow or next week as much as they do today.
Yeah, what are some of those quick gut check indications that something might not be on the up and up?
Well, a few things. First of all, make sure if you're looking at websites that you're donating or you're searching the correct organization. Scammers come up with names that are very similar to good charities. For example, there's a long-standing great charity called the American Cancer Society. Well, a few years ago, somebody came up with a group and a website called the Cancer Fund of America, and they aren't around anymore. They were engaged in deceptive fundraising, and they aren't functioning. But that happens often. If it's for a well-known charity, make sure that the spelling is right, the website is correct, and the name is right, because it's very simple for scammers to throw something out there, and in the hustle and bustle of the holiday season, you may think you're doing good, but you're actually giving your money away.
How about that email we might get with a link? I mean, what I try to do, maybe this is smart, maybe not. Like, if I think it might be legit, might be something I'm interested in, I'll search online for the name of the group rather than clicking on that link to make sure I'm going to the right place.
Oh, that's right. And the phishing scams are big this time of year, too. They're looking for your personal information. If it's anything unsolicited, like I started with, even an email, you shouldn't be clicking links. You know, if there's the old trick, too, you can hover your cursor over the link, and it will show you the actual address that you're going to go to. So even if the text says it's going to, the XYZ fund, you put that over there, and it'll show you, but it might be going somewhere else completely. So, right, go enter the web address yourself, don't click on the links, and just be leery of anything that's coming in your email or even social media. People also look to make charitable donations for the tax benefits of it. And one thing to keep in mind is things you see on Facebook or GoFundMe pages for individuals, they may need your money, but if you donate that way, that is not tax deductible. It's got to be a certified 501c3 charity by the Internal Revenue Service, and you can always ask a charity if they have that 501c3 designation, and you can ask them for a copy of the designation letter from the IRS.
What's at risk if we get scammed? Is it just, the 20 or however many bucks I gave away went to not a good cause, or can it be worse than that?
Well, if you use your credit card, of course it can be worse than that, or it can be just your personal information. But credit cards, the one good thing about them is if you use them and you are scammed, you have a limit to your liability. Usually it's around $50. But the bad news is if someone gets your credit card information, they can go out there and try and use it. When entering your personal information, your name, address, birth date, or a credit card, two things. First of all, you want to make sure in the address line of the website, it's got an S at the end. So it's HTTPS, semicolon, whatever it is, and that S stands for secure. And there's usually a green padlock kind of logo along with that. The other thing you're going to want to do, as boring as it sounds, is check out the protection policy, the personal information policy on a website. They're going to tell you what they're going to do. Are they going to sell your information to somebody else? Are they not going to do that? Every website should have a policy listed like that on there for your personal information.
Talking to Jim Temer with the Better Business Bureau Wisconsin, looking at charitable scams, fake charities, that sort of thing, how to avoid them in this giving season. And Jim, we're saying a lot of negative stuff here, but I'm guessing you're not wanting to discourage people from giving.
Not at all. Give as much as you can. There are so many worthwhile charities, so many worthwhile causes. The people here in Wisconsin are great at supporting people in need, and there is need all over. We don't have to look very far to get that. But what we encourage people to do is you can give with your heart, but you've got to think with your head, because the last thing you want to do is have your money not end up where it's most needed. And the other thing, another thing I should say that you can do is you can check up even legitimate charities and see how much of those funds do go to the actual program itself instead of fundraising expense. You can go to give.org, give.org. That's the BBB's charity arm, and you can get reports on charities there. There's organizations like Charity Navigator or GuideStar that can give you very valuable information. Even our own Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions, the WDFI, has reports on charitable organizations where you can find about their spending levels and other things. So make wise, informed decisions.
And how about, it might be a good idea, it sounds like, instead of waiting for them to come to us with that call or email or social media post, we can take the initiative and try to find groups we want to give to.
Right. We're very big into that. You should be instigating this search. If anything's coming to you, you have to think twice about it. And again, sometimes the telephone solicitors, the telemarketers, they may be working for a legitimate charity, but the costs of telemarketing are huge. So they will be keeping the majority of your donation, and a minority of it will be going to the charity of your choice. So even if you're on the phone with somebody who informs you of a great charity, we still would recommend you don't give them over the phone, but you find that charity's information online and you can give directly. Also, if someone's talking to you on the phone, you should always be able to request that they send you information, again, if it's their 501c3 designation or anything about their programs, and if someone refuses or says they don't want to, that's an immediate red flag.
I understand you are interested in getting kids involved in the giving process. How can we do that?
That's right. You know, we find that definitely when parents are involved with their children in philanthropy, you're going to create possibly a lifelong giver. The very first thing you do is talk to your kids about it. It's significantly more children grow up to be donors if their parents talk to them about it and show and tell them about it. Be upfront with it. Show your kids that you're doing something charitable and then tell them why you did it. The other thing we like to tell people is be a guide and not a boss. You know, let your child discover the causes they care about and nurture their passion. The other thing is, you know, you can tell them you don't have to be millionaires to make a difference. You can offer not only your money, but also your time, your skills, anything that you can to volunteer, and you let your child see there's more to giving than just dollars and cents. But study after study shows the earlier that you can involve kids in philanthropy, the more they're going to get out of it, and the more they're going to be giving back to their society.
Something else on our mind, getting back to potential scams. It's a big shopping season from Black Friday and Cyber Monday through post-holiday deal hunting. How can we watch out for retail scams in person or online?
Well, in person, a few things. You just got to keep yourself safe. Make sure that that credit card that's coming in and out of your wallet or your purse, you know, 10, 15 times in a day is safe and secure. This is a huge season for pickpockets. You know, if you've got 3 shopping bags and your purse slung over your shoulder, it can be maybe easier for you to have that taken from you. When you're walking out to your car and it's nighttime, and again, you've got 5, 6 packages, just make sure you know your surroundings so you stay safe. If you're going store to store, put those packages with your valuables in them in the trunk so people can't see in the window. You do want to keep that credit card safe, but make yourself aware of what's going on. Instead of waiting for your statement to come at the end of the month, go online, check every week so you can see if there are some charges being made on your card that you didn't authorize or that you didn't make. You know, when you're shopping online, you have to be careful that it's a legitimate site. There are a lot of fake sites for merchandise. If it sounds too good to be true, we always say this, but it is. You know, you're not going to get that that specialty item that you find for $500 everywhere else for $100. It's probably a scam. Same thing as I said earlier about the secure socket, the S at the end of the HTTP when you're shopping online. You also want to compare, of course, compare prices, but compare apples to apples. You know, every 27-inch TV isn't the same. So make sure you get model numbers written down when you're shopping so you're actually comparing the same items to each other. Our number one hint, or for anybody this time of year, this has to do with purchasing items or making donations, is make a budget, stick to the budget. You don't want to get yourself in a situation where come January or February you're scrambling around because you spent too much money. It's so easy to do. We have, I mean, myself, people in our office, we've all done this in the past. It's so easy to overspend. So to any consumer that's out there, you know, make a budget and stick to that budget.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You bet. My pleasure. Happy holidays.
Jim Temer is the CEO of the Better Business Bureau Wisconsin. He joined us with some advice for safe and effective year-end charitable giving. If you're going to go online in this world, you're going to need passwords, lots of them, for your online game accounts, bank accounts, utility companies, whatever. You want some good, hard-to-guess passwords. Bad news, we are very, very bad at making up passwords in this country. An annual report from the online security company Splash Data looks at passwords that were revealed in data leaks, and they have a new list now of the top 100 most common. Number one, look out, hackers, it's 123456. The number two password is the word password. Also in the top 10, 12345, 12345677, 12345678, and wait for it, 12345679. You cracked the code. You knew what was coming there. There's a timely one at number 15, Star Wars. Steer clear of that. And a good Wisconsin one at number 28 with Harley. Yes, if the world knows you're a motorcycle owner, they may try that if they're trying to hack your password. There's also QWERTY, which makes sense, Q-W-E-R-T-Y, if you look at your computer keyboard, and other easy-to-type patterns, plus a few swear words, which I can understand if you're having trouble accessing the account. If I have just revealed your password, maybe time to change it to something a little more complicated. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.